Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Arlie R. Hochschild, author most recently of Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, published in September by the New Press, and a finalist for the National Book Award. Her many previous works include, in part, The Outsourced Self, The Unexpected Community, So How's the Family and Other Essays, The Managed Heart, and many others, as I said. Each of these and her other work focuses, at least in my mind, in good part on emotions and how the control of those emotions, or the direction of each, helps to create the everyday world we live in and drives the stressors and the feelings that motivate each of us as we live our workaday lives. Strangers in Their Own Land is about as timely a book as you could possibly imagine. It rides the swell of alt-right anger and mourning and comes close to an expression of the phenomenon that we find ourselves immersed in today as we speak and every day in the past month. And dependent on whether you are one of those strangers or an alt-left like me, you're either ebullient or every day you feel like you're ready for the zombie apocalypse. So with that, Arlie, welcome and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So like the big question, like we were talking about earlier. So did you think in this 5 years of research, did you think that what happened on November 8th of this year was what was going to happen?
No, I would love to claim that I predicted the election of Donald Trump. I can't. What I did see in the 5 years that I spent in Southwest Louisiana among right-wing, you know, Tea Party aficionados, many of them a blue-collar, many Cajun, that I saw what Donald Trump was appealing to. I saw a sense of anxiety at being, as they saw it, marginalized, pushed to the margin, and facing a downward spiral. So when you have a man that says, oh, let's make America great again, appealing to what's been called the, you know, the great yesterday, I understood very well the bell that rang.
Well, you know what? For people who haven't yet read the book, why don't you talk a little bit about, in that five-year period, why you chose Louisiana and the great paradox that you, you know, essentially found there?
Right. 5 years ago in 2011, I already, like many people, saw that Congress was at a standstill and the right and left were growing up farther and farther apart, not because the left was getting more left, but because the right was getting more right, more people were on the right. So I live in Berkeley, California, in a political bubble, and I thought I need to get out to another political bubble that's as far right as Berkeley is left and take my moral and political alarm system off, which is to say, remain completely who I am, and everyone I interviewed, some 60 over a period of 5 years, I said I'm a sociology professor at UC Berkeley, interested in the divide and how it might be bridged. So I was curious to find a place as far apart as I could. So that would be in the South. That would be among whites, older whites, religious older whites. And I chose Louisiana because I looked at the 2012 proportion of whites voting for the re-election of Barack Obama. And in California, it was 50%. In the whole region of the South, it was only 30%. And in Louisiana, it was 14%. So Louisiana was a super South. So I thought, perfect. I'm going to take my moral and political alarm system off. I'm really going to get curious and see if I can understand this super South And I had in mind the so-called red state paradox. How could it be that the poorest states in our country, with the worst education and the worst medical care and health, lowest life expectancy, most disrupted families, are the states that take more federal dollars in aid than they give to it in taxes and hate the federal government? You know, if you have a problem, don't you want a little help? That's the paradox. And it turned out that Louisiana was an exaggeration of that red state paradox, because in 2014, it was actually the poorest state in the union. 44% of its state budget came from the federal government, and it was very right-wing. Very high proportion were sympathetic to the Tea Party, and it went for Donald Trump in the primary and final election. Big numbers. So it was what I didn't get. And so I set out 5 years ago to really try and get to know some people and ask them where they were born. Could we go see? What school did you go to? What row did you sit in school? Where did you, where are your parents buried? Where did you go to church? And really, you know, go fishing with people and sit down for fish fries and try and get to know people as people. And they were very open to that. When I would say, look, I'm coming from my political bubble to get to know you because I'm worried about this divide, they'd say, yeah, we're worried about it too. But it was a different truth, a different world. And in truth, I felt like the stranger in my own land being there.
Well, when you talk about it in that general sense and then drilling down a little bit as you have about going back to their school, things like that, talk a little bit about the one person who was a real conundrum and paradox for me and for you, Lee Sherman.
Yes, yes. I met a man who was originally a pipe fitter but became the fix-it man at Pittsburgh Plate and Glass, a company that produced very many precious but highly dangerous chemicals. And in the course of his work, he had been asked to take a tar buggy with all of these toxic chemicals and hydrochloric acid and dioxins, many different chemicals, and out of view of the public at dusk, discard these hot chemicals, spurt them out into public waters, into the bayou. And he did this because he was asked to do it by his boss. And this was in the 60s. And he became himself ill from these toxic chemicals, was put on a medical leave under the care of the company doctor, who said, don't come back until you can use your legs again. And then he was fired for absenteeism. So he had no love for this company, and he became an environmentalist. But at the same time, he became extremely right-wing. In fact, through his life, he's in his 80s now, he started as a conservative Democrat and then moved to a moderate, Republican, and then to a extreme right Republican. He now puts lawn signs in for a local Tea Party candidate. So how did a man who had suffered so much at the hands of industry turn out to be to aim all his fire at the federal government? That became the question I asked. And a piece of his story too was that once he was fired, after that there was a seafood advisory, that is a notice sent to the public, watch out for, don't eat so many of these fish, they're contaminated. And a huge uproar on the part of fishermen and restaurant owners who felt this was going to be an economic disaster for for them. And then there was a huge meeting in Burton Coliseum in Lake Charles, and these fishermen were angry at the government until Lee Sherman, this character in Strangers in the Land, gets up with a sign that says, "I'm the guy that dumped it in the water." In other words, that dumped the toxic waste in the water. And all the fishermen were, you could hear a pin drop, 1,000 fishermen suddenly got it. Uh-oh, these fish really are contaminated. This isn't just the government trying to stop us from having a decent job. This is a real problem that industry caused. So that's Lee Sherman. He's lived a very colorful life, and now he is a total Trump person. And Trump, you know, one of the very first things he was clear on was the abolition of the Environmental Protection Agency. So the paradox remains.
It's very hard, especially for, I have the luxury of not having to give up my values in order to investigate here. I have my very, very left-wing values, so it becomes extremely difficult for me when I'm reading your book, which was wonderful, in trying to wrap my head around these concepts. I know these people all listened to coverage. They listened to the words that Trump said. I know they're all religious. I know that some of the things he said about sex and other aspects of moral things were totally anathema to him, to them. And yet I don't know how they could, I don't know how it's possible for them to have ignored all that.
Well, here's, and that's, I think, the message of my book is to try and answer that question. But let me just back up and say, you know, I have my values too. And here's, it's possible to take your alarm system off and still be who you are.
I agree.
In other words, the task of this book was to try and climb an empathy wall. And it's interesting, a number of people before I set out 5 years ago would say, "Oh, I could never go and talk to them. I'd be so mad."
Yes.
"Be so angry." Or others kind of looked at me. You could see an expression on their face. They didn't say anything. But I think what they were thinking is, "Oh, well, if she's going over there, she must be pretty right-wing herself." And there's a missing idea in those two reactions, which is that you can't quite naturally just listen and remain yourself. You know, and that's what the point of the book is, that there's a lot to be gained by doing that so that we know what we're dealing with here. We're not just blind punching, "Oh, you must be a racist. Oh, you must be an awful person just because you don't agree with me." Well, you know, not so fast. That's not wise for us to do. Before we get together an organizational strategy for how to defend all the, really, the victories of the last 100 years, which I think are now in danger.
Yes.
Victories for diversity and for human rights and for a free press. I think we have to know what those who disagree with us are like, what their circumstances are, and how they came to feel the way they do. And I came to it through my answer to the Red State Paradox was that they knew about this. They felt ashamed that Louisiana was so poor and at the bottom of all these rankings on education and health. But something else was more important to them. And that something else I came to call the deep story. Well, what's the deep story? My thesis is that all of us, whatever left or right, have an underlying deep story. And that deep story is a story of life as it actually feels, life among your social peers as it feels. So you take facts out of the deep story and you take moral judgments out of just how it feels. And to them, these 40 Tea Party Deep South people that interviewed 60 people in all. For them, the deep story was that they're waiting in line as in a pilgrimage up to the top of the hill at, on which stands the American dream. And you've been waiting a long time. Your feet are tired. You haven't had a raise in many years. And you've obeyed all the rules. You've really worked hard. And then you see in the deep story, at felt as if story, there are these line cutters, people cutting in line. Well, who are they? They're women who now have, through affirmative action, been given access to jobs formerly reserved for men. They're blacks, through affirmative action, used to have access to jobs that are formerly reserved for whites. They're immigrants, refugees, even endangered animals. Many people said, gosh, these liberals are putting animals ahead of us. And so it felt as if line cutters who were then, another moment in the deep story is that Barack Obama, who should be impartially regulating the line, is waving to the line cutters. He's sponsoring the line cutters.
Well, not only that, what you say in your book, and this is where I draw the line. I say, okay, there's a point where I have to draw the line. I think it's important that you listen. I think, like, for a pro-choice, pro-life argument, I think people don't listen to one another. I always mm-hmm. listen to both sides. I think good left-wing people do. That's why I am embracing the left wing, because I listen. But when mm-hmm. you say that Barack Obama and Michelle Obama have stepped into the line as well, that one yeah. section of the book where you say that, it just seems to me that you can only believe that if you are an ignorant person. If you believe that they went to Yale and to Harvard because they somehow were benefited by something that they shouldn't have gotten, then it gets to the point where I finally have to say, you're just being ignorant. I'm sorry.
I know that they shouldn't have gotten. It's really interesting. What people would say is, how could a single mother afford that high, you know, $40,000, $50,000 a year? How could she afford it? And they're thinking of it in very market-oriented privatist terms. In other words, there wouldn't be a policy at a university to admit students' needs blind on the basis of their abilities, right? That was a missing idea in their perspective, right?
But, yeah,
they couldn't imagine that Harvard would admit a man that Harvard had such a policy. So that's kind of interesting. They said, well, my mother couldn't afford it. I could never get there because they're not imagining.
But Barack Obama was in the same situation as they were when he was a youth. I'm privileged. Had I not been privileged, would I have been able to lift myself up by my own bootstraps and accomplish anything that any of these people have done? I don't know. But the idea of the American dream is that, yes, they were.
That's right.
But what bothers me is that you can take this. Unfortunately, there is no more playing field since Trump's been elected. How can you explain to these people that Rudolph Giuliani is being considered for Secretary of State, or that Ben Carson was just appointed Director of Housing and Urban Development because he once lived in a house? I mean, how is that even? It's very difficult. If I go to Barnes & Noble instead of my independent bookstore, which I would go there first, but mm-hmm. if I go to Barnes & Noble and I look at the front left quarter of the magazines and I see a Foreign Affairs Quarterly, mm-hmm. where I see one of your books, what is the point of me buying that book and reading it now when there is no more playing field anymore? It's a Twitter-driven policy world now.
Time to organize.
But we are not going to be, Democrats and alt-lefters like us are not going to be the people that put barricades in the middle of the road like in Les Miserables. We talk.
We talk, and we organize. And you know what Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor under Clinton, and I think a very wise man.
I agree.
An author of many books, a Harvard professor now. now he's here at Berkeley. And he has put out with MoveOn.org a kind of 5 or 6 point plan. And part of it is, hey, look, you know, people on the progressive side of the spectrum have to learn that maybe we need something like a Tea Party. Maybe we ourselves need to organize at the grassroots level and start at local level around a variety of issues, including diversity and including civil rights and rights of expression, so that it's true that the cast of characters you just mentioned will be in charge of very important areas of life, but we're not going away. And Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by, I think it's 2.5 million, the count is up to now. So we're not invisible, we're not absent, but what we really need to do is get up a plan. And I think the plan should have two parts to it. One is to organize peacefully, to get writing out, to get civic expression, to have demonstrations, and a variety of events so that we are forever present and the Twittering can be about these events as expressions of our values and holding on to really all the advances of a century.
But
on the one hand that, and on the other hand are reaching out to the people who really disagree with us, people who voted for Trump, and many of whom who voted for Obama. It's not everybody that's for Trump is deplorable, not at all. They're just people looking for a way out of their predicament, people who are afraid. And I think the Democratic Party, used to be the party of the working man and woman, has dropped the ball and did not offer many of these people what they were very anxious to receive, which is some sense of recognition and in the form of policies that would help them. So not that the Democratic Party hasn't been for the minimum wage and for labor organizing, certain issues it's been great on, but I think in larger sense, a certain neoliberal kind of acceptance of Wall Street and so on has led it to not appeal to this group of people. And I think so the second stroke that we need, second thing we need to do is to get channels of communication through churches, through schools, through labor unions, with the right wing, and see if we can find some common ground.
You're more optimistic than me. Although it was interesting that Al Gore met with Trump and his daughter to talk about climate change, I thought that would fit nicely into your paradigm there.
That's right. That's right. It's not the only thing to do, but it should also be going on. And we should not just sit there and throw epithets at people who don't agree with us.
But some of these people, they
cuts us off.
They deserve to have epithets thrown against them. They're horrible people. Rudy Giuliani is an insane man. There's something wrong with him. He could have.
But wait a minute. We're talking about two different theys. I'm talking. my they is the 40 people that over 5 years I really came to know well, who are Tea Party and Trump, and who are very decent, thoughtful people, capable of ambivalence. They didn't love Trump. They felt he was the only plausible possibility for them. It's not that they approved of him at all.
But you and I...
Well, anyway, that's different from Rudy.
You and I are of a certain generation, and what happens is I never thought that the technology would... I thought I would ride this wave of technology until I got into my 80s, and But now I realize technology has, the wave has gone way ahead of me, and I'm back here paddling, not seeing what's happening with Twitter, for example, is the most important thing in the world right now. And
but
then
you know, Twitter can be on this, is, I think, politically neutral. Look, but technology, you know, MoveOn.org, the largest by far a kind of political organization on the left, right? Over 8 million, I think, subscribers to it. Started by Joan Blades and Wes Boyd here in the Bay Area. And Moms Rising is another organization, you know, millions of members. That technology has brought together people on the progressive side.
Yes, but you have a president, a vice president, a speaker of the House, a secretary of state. You have the House, you have the Senate, you have the Supreme Court with a super conservative majority. I mean, it's turtles all the way down. And it's like they talk about Trump being impeached. Well, if he's impeached, and you could go down the line to the seventh person in succession, and you'd still have the same exact problem. I was listening to YouTube the other night, and I don't know how I found it, but I listened to a debate between James Baldwin and William F. Buckley at Cambridge in 1965. And I said to myself, you know, I will never, ever hear again this level of civil discourse in my lifetime. And I realized, I'm right. I won't. I will never ever hear that.
It can be turned around. I'm not as pessimistic. And if you, you know, in that's my discovery 5 years later, in having gotten to know the people I write about in Strangers in Their Own Land. They were eager for real conversation with people on the liberal left, actually. And they wanted to be understood. And that in the right context, they can be very open about their own ambivalences.
Yes, and it was lovely that you were able to sit down with them and have cake and have sweet tea. And I understand the concept. What you were trying to get across was that these are they're nice people. People are people. They're nice. They give money to the Salvation Army. If someone moves in, they bring them a housewarming gift or a casserole or something. If someone's sick, they take care of them. I understand all of that, and I hate to do this because it always sounds wrong. But if you go back to Germany in the 1930s, you have soldiers who were doing horrible things, but then they would come home and they would visit with their family and they would rub their pet's belly and they would go next door and have dinner with their friends. There's a dichotomy here.
You're right about that. So the question that I think the challenge ahead of us is to think, what would have happened in Germany if the progressives had all risen up and said, you know what, we've got to stop this thing. What are the five ways we do it? And I think that's the situation we're in.
Maybe.
Incidentally, Germany, there were, you know, 40 or 50% unemployed. It was a much more dire kind of economic situation that Hitler was speaking to.
But if you think back in Germany at the time that we're discussing, there probably were salons where people, including many Jewish people, would get together and say, as you know, Hitler's a buffoon, this will just last for a little bit, and then things
run
back
to normal.
That's
right, couldn't happen here.
Yeah, and I think because I'm the pessimist and you're, in my opinion, the Pollyanna, I think that that's what we're doing now, is we're talking about it as if it's something that's happened we can address, and I'm looking at it as something that's happened, like the phone call to Taiwan, or lots of things like that. And he's not even president yet. He's not even the president. He's just canceled Air Force One, and there are things happening that have never happened before, and it's just the beginning of that. And I think talking about it as if it's a phenomenon makes smaller something that's really, really gigantic in our life today.
It is. We don't disagree on the
enormity.
On the enormity of this, we do not. What we do disagree on is how to face it.
Yes.
And we are remember Hillary got 2.5 million more popular votes than Trump did.
Which means what to you?
I mean, it means that a lot of people don't go along with this, and a lot of people probably share our fear.
But
that's what it means.
Okay, well, if it does mean that, then it's no different than those people in Germany who were afraid. They were very, very afraid, and they did what some people do now, which is emigrate, leave the country, or the other ones who stayed, what came of them became of them. And I'm not, I mean, it sounds like I'm being horrible, but all I'm saying is that just the parallels to me seem to be there.
And we don't disagree on that. For me, this is a realization of those parallels, and they're ones I talked about even before the election of Donald Trump. We don't disagree on that, but what we're concluding different things from it.
Yes.
And I am very much like what a Robert Reich has written from moveon.org. You know, he's got kind of a six-point strategy he's proposing. And it does call on people of good faith on the progressive side to get together and organize at the local and state levels and in many different ways. And
I think
have a look at
I will. I would definitely will, and I respect him as well as you do. But it's like you. I think you look at this as a challenge, which is great. And unfortunately, I'm looking at it like Eeyore and Winnie the Pooh. And it's because, like, for example, I'm reading the Times Literary Supplement today, and there was an article about torture and why torture doesn't work. And,
mm-hmm.
and it began by saying George Bush said we don't torture. Obama said we tortured some folks. And then you have Trump saying not only should we go beyond torture and waterboarding, mm-hmm. we should torture all the families of all the people that we think are suspects. And, of mm-hmm. course, a lot of that was just his bluster, I understand, but what happens
no,
when
but
someone
bluster is dangerous. Bluster is dangerous.
And
yeah.
but and what happens is what bothers me is that it's hard for me to have discussions because when I read an article like that, I realize it's a well-written article. It's very erudite. It's very well researched, and its conclusions are correct. That torture elicits not much information from anybody. Where I am now in my desperation is that that article means nothing anymore because it's just these tweets of what we're going to do, but who we're going to torture that now control our government and our policies. This article is not something that Donald Trump is going to read
mm-hmm.
or anybody that he's appointed. And Sarah Palin is not going to read that article.
Mm-mm.
And that's what scares me so much. I can't...
Well, then we need to get
to what?
Out. Well, through the organizations we have schools, we have churches, we have civic organizations, we have labor unions, we have neighborhoods, and I think across enclave organizations are especially important here, and. To give talks about torture. You know, if Fox News is not telling the truth to people about torture, we need to get on the soapbox and talk about it, get conversations going. I mean, this really should be a moment of galvanization.
It should be.
It's not a moment to galvanize our capacities as... we can't do it alone. We have to do it in community.
But
I
what
think
we,
that's how.
But what America, what this is, my house was built in 1775, so it was there before the great American experiment began. And now my feeling is that I don't think that you can dissuade, perhaps because I'm irrational, but is that my house will be there during the end of the great American experiment. Experiments do have conclusions, and history does repeat itself. And it's nice to believe that by simply being reasonable and explaining to people why they're wrong and why something should be something that it's not, it's nice to believe that that can happen. But I'm right now, it's it feels
okay.
Like...
Okay. You know what? I understand very much your feeling about your house might have been built at the beginning of the Great American Experience and outlasted, and it's a down moment.
Yes,
really for us all. I get that, but you know, I'm probably older. I'm sure I'm older than you are, and came into my really political awareness in the 1960s when there were very few women on the Berkeley campus, for example, or any campus in, as a faculty, or really 4% of any faculty at Berkeley were women when I got here, you know. And I thought to myself, the way you did too, oh gosh, you know, this is never going to change. You know, nothing I could do could alter the course of events. But it turned out that across the nation there was a social movement in which people thought, you know what, women are human beings, why don't we get a chance to, you know, have access to jobs and make our contribution in public life. And something really changed, not immediately, but over the course of 40 years, it changed enormously. The same for blacks. This was a social movement. And you know, I remember when everybody smoked. Everybody, my professors, they had pipes, but everybody else had cigarettes. I myself smoked. Smoking was just a thing. And then some really smart people got together and made some hilarious ads that went on television. And there was, I remember one, it was of a cowboy who, you know, comes and it's in the Midwest, and he opens the saloon door and he said, all right, you know, everybody stick up your hands. And then he begins to cough. And then he falls down, you know, in the saloon. And everyone's gawking at it. And then at the very end it said, brought to you by the American Cancer Association.
I remember that.
So fabulous, you know, and things like that with that amount of imagination put together with some media savvy and kind of a national alert was a bit appeal to people's self-interest. You know, you don't want to die of cancer. Why do we have this funny habit? Is there an industry who has an interest in promoting it? Yes, there is. Well, let's get some investigative reports out on that, and let's start a movement. Now, you know, you get on United Airlines. I was just on it yesterday, you know, and it's the usual announcement, you know, no smoking allowed. So things can change that look hopeless at the beginning. So I'm speaking to your moment of hopelessness by referring to times in my lifetime when they looked hopeless but weren't.
It just seems different. And also, it's a question of whether we go backwards, not forwards now. But I will say this, like when you watch Saturday Night Live now and Alec Baldwin lampooning Trump, the weird thing about it is that Trump then is watching Saturday Night Live, and he's then tweeting back things about why he hates it, and he ends it with the word sad. His tweets are all like middle school girls. They all are written in the parlance of the semantics and syntax of middle school girls. And you wonder, this is the president who's watching Saturday Night Live and then commenting on about how he doesn't feel like the impersonation by Alec Baldwin. That's where it seems different. It just seems like a strange divide.
Okay, you're right, it's different. So we've got a new challenge. Let's get, you know, together. We've got to do it in community and be smart about it and use technology ourselves.
Yeah, I think that that we need more people like you and less of me.
And you. And we're out there. There are a lot of us. It's not a question of numbers. It's a question of formulating our goals and our communities and our short and long-term kind of ways of addressing the dangers we see.
Well, you know, I feel better now having spoken to you for this past 40 minutes. But yeah. And your book was really, it was a wonderful book to read, and it was so prescient. I don't know if you set out to have it be that way, but, you know, just as it arrived, this whole topic we've been discussing for this time arrived as well. And it was
I have a good alarm system.
You really must. And in all your previous books, you do as well, too. So I don't know what it is that you tap into, but...
Well, it's good to be able to have our alarm systems on.
Yeah.
I did at the beginning. And to be able to take them off in order to learn something, and then to put them back on.
That's a good way to end, I think.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for being here, and thank you for putting up with me, too.
You're great.
Okay.
You're great. Good luck.
We were speaking with Arlie Hochschild. She has written Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, a book that describes the anger and mourning of the Tea Party and their fear and trepidation and angst about their position in the world, in the country, and the fact that they believe that they've been stepped on, that they butted in line ahead of them. And now they've gotten what they wanted, which is Trump being elected, which I'm, you know, going crazy over. And she's being a good public citizen by saying it's a challenge that we need to face, read Robert Reich's 6-point plan, and do some of the things at MoveOn.org. And then talking about the fact that the popular vote indicates that there's more people in America that support the viewpoint of the Democratic Party than the Republican Party. And all this is arguable. There's people that are going to argue both sides of it. But it was nice to talk to someone who is a sociologist and is a really, really smart person, has looked at this problem closely. And the book, as I said, Strangers in Their Own Land, is an excellent book. And it was longlisted and shortlisted for the National Book Award. And I would highly recommend it. So we have coming up, do I have what we have coming up? We have a debut novelist, Emily Friedland. She's going to be discussing her highly anticipated novel, History of Wolves. And then a professor from Penn, Lisa Servan, is going to, another book kind of like this one, The Unbanking of America, How the New Middle Class Survives. And finally, we're joined by Josh Barkin, who has a new extraordinary, so I'm told, I haven't read it yet, collection of short stories entitled Mexico. So as always, for a complete list, you can go to Podomatic. You can go to iTunes, or you can go to our website or any of other social media, including the damnable Twitter. So as always, thank you so much for joining us today, and we hope that you join us again next week here on The Avid Reader.